I will confess to you that some subjects humble me much more than others, and to think of the greatness of God and to study tonight about the majesty of God is indeed a humbling experience. Majesty, to think of greatness, and as we have just sung, the greatness of God, how great thou art. And yet the Bible wants us to look at that, and in many passages talks about the greatness and majesty of God and God himself as he reveals himself to various ones in the scripture, proclaims his own greatness. And essential to our worship and our attitude in worship is an appreciation of the greatness of God. And therefore, our purpose in the lesson tonight is to enhance our understanding and our appreciation of the greatness of God. We have studied in this month so far lessons about the knowledge of God. And the knowledge of God, of course, should include an appreciation of his majesty. Majesty is from the Latin word meaning greatness. And you will find in various translations either greatness or majesty in the same place. And so it may be, as you look in your translations at the passages we'll be studying tonight, that you'll have a different word, but the meaning will be the same, and that is the exceeding greatness of God. Calling someone in this life, as one might refer to royalty, as your majesty or your royal majesty, is a way of recognizing their position. It is a way of recognizing their greatness. If one of you engineers were being honored, let's say, in London, England, by some professional organization, and a messenger came to you and said, Her Majesty the Queen wants you, while you're in London, to see her, and that would be a great honor, and you would immediately want to know the protocol and just exactly what you should say and how you should respond. But basic to all of that would be the understanding that you are in the presence of Her Royal Majesty. Here's a person who is great. Here's an individual who has an influence throughout the whole world and whose long line of ancestors has had an influence throughout the world. And so greatness, majesty, is what we're talking about tonight as we think of God. And the Bible uses this repeatedly to talk about the majesty of God. For example, in Psalms 93, verses 1 and 2, the Lord reigneth, he is clothed with majesty. Thy throne is established of old, thou art from everlasting. And so God is clothed with majesty. Everything about him is majestic. And as we will look tonight, the Lord willing, about many passages and things that are involved in the work and character of God, you will see his majesty exhibited in all of those. Look at these passages, for example. In Psalms 145 and verse 5, the psalmist said, I will speak of the glorious honor of thy majesty and of thy wondrous works. In 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 16, where we are spending a great deal of time this year as we study about being transformed into the divine nature, Peter says we were eyewitnesses of his majesty, referring no doubt to the transfiguration. After talking about adding to your faith virtue, knowledge, and the other things mentioned there, so that these things would work in us to transform our lives and change our nature toward the divine nature, Peter reveals an amazing experience that he and two other of the apostles had experienced. They had been able to see demonstrated the majesty of God at the transfiguration. I believe he is referring to what the Jews call the Shekinah. It is that light. It is the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. It is the smoke in the temple. It is all of those ways by which God demonstrated his greatness and his majesty in the Old Testament and here in the New. as the visible manifestation of the invisible God. And so Peter had the rare experience of seeing Jesus transformed before him, so that he was so white that he searches, as it were, for words to describe the whiteness, the brilliance of the person of Jesus. And so he said, we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. In Hebrews chapter 1, in fact, two passages in Hebrews speak of the majesty of God. When Jesus went back to heaven, it is said of him that he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. And so Jesus is where the majesty of God is. And in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 11, we have such a high priest who is set at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. And so the Bible reveals in these verses and many others, more than we can cover tonight, the majesty of God. And in every case, it is a reference to the exceeding greatness of God. All of these passages emphasize his greatness and are an invitation to worship. In the presence of greatness, we feel something, we experience something that we do not in other circumstances. And to behold and to think of the greatness of God should drive us to our knees and make us want to worship the Almighty. He is majestic. And the connection between worship and majesty, I want to explore for just a minute. As you think about worship and majesty, expressions like on high and in heaven are not to emphasize how far God is from us in space, but how far God is from us in greatness, and therefore to be worshiped and to be adored. And the point I want to make is that God is both personal and majestic. In the same person, we have both of those characteristics. In Psalms 95, verses 3 and 6, these expressions, "The Lord is the great God, the great King. Come, let us bow down and worship." Our instincts are to trust and to worship, and those are stimulated very powerfully by consideration of the greatness of God. And so God is so very great. He is majestic, and yet he is personal. Now, it is difficult for us to tie those two concepts together, because greatness and majesty often means aloofness, sometimes arrogance in some people who are your majesty. But with God, majesty and being personal are in the same being. God is personal and yet majestic. Now, we are limited in time and in space. We are very limited in our knowledge and in our power. But God is unlimited. He is infinite. He is eternal. God is almighty. And as we think of God, and as we try to grasp the notion of a majestic God, so different from us as far as majesty is concerned, we recognize that he has us in his hands. We never have him in our hands. Our God is not one to be manipulated and managed and shaped by us. And we make a terrible mistake if we seek to make God in our image. You see, if we do that, then our God is much too small. Our God is so great. He is so majestic that we must always view him in that light and not as someone that we can invent or manage ourselves. I believe that the early chapters in the book of Genesis show us these two sides of God. And so I want to spend just a few minutes exploring that with you. We studied about the early chapters of Genesis this morning in Greg's lesson. And in those same chapters, in that same part of the Bible, as God is being revealed to mankind in the book of Genesis, we see both of those very powerful ideas. We see, first of all, that God is very personal. He says, for example, in Genesis 1, verse 26, "Let us make man in our image," speaking to the other parts of the Godhead. He says in that plural expression for God, "Let us make man in our image." And so here is a very personal touch, and it gives each of us great hope and aspirations as we think about the fact that there is a part of us that is like God, that He gave us not only a body, but within that body He placed an immortal soul, a part of you and me that shall live forever. And so God made man in His own image. He brings the animals to Adam. You remember that story, to name them. He walks in the garden. He talks with Adam and Eve. He grieves over human wickedness. He comes down to see what His creatures are doing as they build the great tower. And in all of those ways, you see that God is very personal. He is involved with man. He is not a remote deity far from us and so far above us that He pays no attention to us. He is not a disinterested creator. He is not a cold and impersonal force. He is not a cosmic principle. God is a living being, a living person, approving good, disapproving evil. And He is interested in His creatures all of the time. Now notice again, personal yet majestic. Think of God in those same chapters, in that same part of the book of Genesis. And you will notice as you look at those passages that He spoke the world into existence. Talk about majesty. Talk about power. Here is power so great, just to say it was to make it so. He spoke and it was so. And so God spoke the world into existence. He created life, both physical life and spiritual life. And He is Lord of all that He made. He curses the ground. He floods the whole earth in judgment. He confounds human language and ambition. He overthrows Sodom and Gomorrah, and the list could go on and on. In all of those, you see the mighty majesty and power of God. He is personal, and yet He is majestic. His majesty is so apparent in a number of passages. Let me mention two or three examples. One is in the story where Abraham and his more than 300 trained soldiers in his own household went and rescued his nephew Lot from some city kings who had gotten together and had captured Lot and his family and some others. And so on his return from the defeat of those enemies, the king of Salem, Melchizedek, who was also a priest of the Most High God, came out and blessed Abraham. And in so doing, he, as a man of God, speaks of Jehovah as God Most High, maker of heaven and earth. But what is interesting to me is that three or four verses later, as Abraham speaks of God, he uses the same term. He adopts Melchizedek's term for God, and that shows the majesty that he came maybe to appreciate more fully as he met Melchizedek. And so the majesty of God comes through in these chapters. God is present everywhere. He is observing everything. He sees Cain's murder of his brother. He sees mankind's corruption. He sees the destitution of Hagar and her hopeless situation. And He sees and He hears everything. Hagar's name for God is quite interesting. She named Him El Roi, which means the God who sees me. He saw her there in the wilderness and saw her situation and was eager to help her. And then she named her son Ishmael, God hears is what that means. And so Hagar had an appreciation for the fact that this majestic God could see and hear everything. Nothing escapes him. Older preachers used to tell the story of a man who was stealing corn, roasting ears, from his neighbor's field, and he would get up about daybreak and he would ease into that field, and he wouldn't gather it along the edge. He would go deep into the field where it wouldn't be apparent till harvest, and he would take his sack and he would fill it with those roasting ears, and then he would come out to the edge, and crawling out to the edge, he would look this way and look that way, and then he would beat a retreat to his house. Story goes that on one of those occasions, his little son wanted to go with him, and so they accomplished their mission, and as they crawled out to the edge, and he looked this way, and he looked that way, that his little son nudged him and pointed upward. He had forgotten to look upward. God sees when men do not see. God sees and hears everything. And you think about the majesty of one who knows our heart. He sees, he hears everything. There is along about here in the book of Genesis, the promises made to Abraham and to Sarah. And you remember the promise of a son when they were so very old. And Sarah laughs at the promise of God and says, "Shall I have pleasure at this point in my life, and my husband is so old?" And God, of course, saw that and heard that, and she tried to deny it, but of course there was no denying it because God heard what she said, and it was incredible to her that that could be true. And God said something very interesting as recorded over in chapter 18 and verse 14. He asked Abraham and Sarah, he said, "Is anything too hard for the Lord? You think I can't do this? Do you not realize the kind of God that you're serving? The majesty of God." And Abraham and Sarah came to appreciate that, I believe, in a new way. As you think about the majesty of God, I believe our task tonight as we look at that is to ask ourselves the question, how can I form a right idea of God's majesty? How can I grasp something so high and so wonderful, so far above me and above you and our capabilities? I believe there are two steps. One, we must remove from our minds somehow and thoughts any limits that would make him small. We've got to figure out ways that we do not reduce God down to human terms. That's step one. Step two, to comprehend God's majesty, we must compare him with the powers and forces that we regard as very, very great. And that's the best we can do. This is all we have. But I believe those two steps, faithfully carried out, will give us an appreciation for the majesty of God, perhaps greater than we have had before. Step number one, removing from our thoughts that which would make God too small in our estimation. A good place to begin to do that is to read Psalms 139, beginning at verse 7. "Whether shall I go from thy spirit, or whether shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day, and the darkness and the light are both alike unto thee." And so, if we should try to go anywhere, and the psalmist describes it all the way from heaven above to hell beneath, and all the places in between. One could include all of the unexplored parts of the world, the farthest reaches of the sea, the places, and there probably are some, where human foot has never trod. Anywhere we would go in this whole world, even there, God is there. Any part of the day, any part of the night is like the day to Him. He can see as well at night as He can in the day. And so there is no place, no circumstance in which we can escape the all-seeing eye of the Lord. He knows the whole world, and there is no place hidden from Him. And the psalmist takes it to another level. In the earlier verses, verses 1 through 4, he says, within myself there is no place where I may escape. O Lord, Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my down-sitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down. Thou art acquainted with all my ways. There is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, Thou knowest it altogether. Not only does He know the whole world in every place, He knows me. He knows my mind. He knows all the places in my mind and in my conscience to which I might go. He knows every effort that I might make to rationalize my behavior and somehow excuse myself before God. And so we're dealing with a being who knows all of our ways. And as we think about that He knows all of our ways, He knows my habits, my plans, my aims, my desires. He knows the record of my life. I may have forgotten this or that I have said or done in the past. Not God. He knows. He remembers it all. And so God knows all of that. He is so great. He is so majestic. I can hide my heart from others. I might not tell them about something in my past. I might keep that so carefully concealed that nobody ever knows. There are people who resolve to take secrets with them to the grave, and some I suspect who do, but not with God. He knows my past. He knows my future plans. He knows all the things that I might hide from those around me, but I can't hide anything from God. And have you thought about the fact that if we could, if somehow we could conceal a thing from the Almighty, that would be an awfully small and trivial God that we're serving? Do you want to serve a God and you are greater than He and you can conceal something and He'll never know? Well, we do not serve such a God. He is a deity who knows everything. And when we think those thoughts about the majesty of God, I believe that life becomes an awesome business when we realize that we spend it openly before God. He knows everything about me and about you. And so we need to be serious about this business of serving the Lord. He knows all of that. And furthermore, He reveals His power and His knowledge in the complexity of our own physical bodies. He made a body for our spirits that is an amazing thing. Now, if you're hurting and you're sick, you may think your body's not so amazing, but it truly, truly is. So much so that the psalmist was compelled to worship God. And in Psalms 139, verse 14, said, I will praise Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Have you noticed as you get older that you hear of diseases or conditions or things you never heard of before? I heard of one just last week. I was had the privilege of meeting David Stubblefield's brother, and he told me about a rare condition that he has. And if I understood him correctly, he said there's only about 300 cases of this in the whole world. Talk about being rare. That is rare indeed. Our bodies are amazing. And the more we study them, the more those who are qualified to study and analyze learn about them, the more amazed they are by our bodies. And that is a testimony to the majesty of the one who made us. We will not have time to deal with Elihu in the book of Job, but I commend to you the chapters 32 through 37, which point Job to the majesty of God. And Elihu got it right when he said in 37, verse 42, "With God is terrible majesty." Here is a majesty that ought to fill us with awe and even terror as we think about the one whom we serve. It is on the heels of that speech that God then, in the next several chapters, beginning at chapter 38, asked Job a series of questions revealing his own intricate creative power, and asked Job all along through those chapters, "Can you do this? Where were you when I laid the foundation of the world? Can you do this? Can you do that? Can you?" And of course, Job is speechless. He can do none of those things. And finally, Job gets it. And he realizes that since he cannot match God in any of those things, even begin to, that he surely is in no position to find fault with God or the ways of God in his own experiences. We're dealing with a majestic God. Step two. We may begin to comprehend God's majesty when we compare him with powers and forces which we regard as very, very great. I need for you to turn with me to the 40th chapter of Isaiah, and we will cover this hurriedly in view of our time. In chapter 40 of Isaiah, the following comparisons are made: great tasks, great nations, this great world, the world's great ones, and the stars. Those five things are used to teach us the majesty of God. First, great tasks. In verse 12, Isaiah writes, "Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out heaven with a span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance?" Who has been able to do that? Are you and I wise enough and mighty enough to do any of those things? And we say, absurd. Of course, I cannot do any of those things. But God says, I'm mighty enough to do that. I know how many gallons of water there are in the ocean. I know the measurements of heaven. I know the amount of dust in the earth. All of those things boggle our minds, do they not? But God can do all of those. We can do none of those. Look at great nations. In verses 15 and 17, "Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very small thing. All nations before him are as nothing. They are counted to him less than nothing in vanity." They were so concerned about Babylon and Assyria and to some degree Egypt. They were concerned about all of those things. And rightly so. They were imminent dangers to them. And God said, "They're nothing. They're nothing. They are passing on the scene." And so the great nations are of the earth are not a threat in any way to God. Look at the great world. He challenges us to look at the world and says, it is He. It is the Almighty. It is the majestic God who sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are His grasshoppers that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. And so we think about this great world in which we live, and we think about how far it is from one side to the other and one place to another, and all of the things that we have not yet perhaps explored or even thought about or read about. And God, as it were, sitteth on the circle of the earth, high above it all, and looks down upon it. And as we would sit on a summer evening and look at the grasshoppers playing in the grass, so God sees the inhabitants of this world as they rush to and fro and are so busy about many things. That is the great God that we serve. His majesty is seen in consideration and comparison with the world's great ones, the people of the world. God brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth as vanity. There were people who were so great in their time, and they thought of themselves, and others thought of them as great, but they were passing. They are as nothing in comparison with God. They are, like Shakespeare wrote, like an actor upon a stage that makes its entrance, plays his little part, and then exit, and we see him no more. And so the great people of the earth are passing, but God still is. And so the greatness of God in comparison to the world's great ones helps us to understand the majesty of God. But he reserves the most awesome comparison as the last one here in the 40th chapter of Isaiah. And in this comparison, he challenges us to look at the stars. And I love this passage, verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high. Behold, who hath created these things? Who bringeth out their host by number? He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one faileth. Parallel passages in Psalms 147 and verse 4 and in Job 38, 31 through 33 show God actually calling the stars by number and naming some of the constellations. Isn't that amazing? And you think about the fact that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Job, and all through the centuries, there were people who walked out in the evening and wondered and looked at the stars. Maybe they knew the names of some of those constellations. And though it may be hard to find a place away from city lights, if you or I are able to do that same thing, it's a wonderful experience to go out and just look at the stars. God said, look at those. I made those. I know all their names. Can you do that? Can you do anything that even compares with that? The majesty of the God whom we serve. One writer has said that the most universally awesome experience that mankind knows is to stand alone on a clear night and look at the stars. The conclusions I want to draw from all of that are found also in this passage, and I need for you to read with me these three verses. There are some typical responses to the majesty of God, and they are shown in this chapter in three parts. In verse 25, "To whom then will you liken me? Or shall I be equal, saith the Lord, saith the Holy One." The great tendency, as I mentioned earlier, is to compare God to ourselves. And we have, when we do that, very wrong thoughts about the majesty of God. The second mistake is in verse 27. "Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, thy way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God?" We may accuse God or think God doesn't care about us. And that's very wrong thoughts about ourselves. We are important in His sight. He sent His Son to die for us. He loves us. We are always within His sight and His hearing. And so God loves you and me. He is concerned about us. He is very concerned about our eternal destiny and has invited us to come to Him and to pattern our lives so that we become like Him and that we are being fitted for eternity in His presence. And so it is a terrible mistake if we think somehow that God has forgotten us. And the third mistake, verse 28, hast thou not known, hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary, there's no searching of His understanding. And we may think of God even as old and tired, and that He is weary as we are weary. And so He rebukes us for our slowness to believe in His majesty. And so the majesty of God all through the Bible points us to one so great and so mighty that we are driven to our knees to worship Him. He is majestic. And as we think of that, that will help us to tune our hearts to His will and to realize what it is to be in the presence of one who knows us and yet loves us and who has provided for us. Tonight, I can tell you with complete assurance that He has made provision for you. He knows your name. He knows all about you. He knows your needs. And if you aren't a Christian, He knows just the place for you to feel in His kingdom. There's room in the kingdom of God for you. And He wants to invite you to Him. And we invite you as the bride of Christ, the church, to believe and to obey the gospel of Christ.